Joining us right now is Jaina Davis. She was a former NBC affiliate reporter for an Oklahoma City station during the Oklahoma City bombings, and has done a lot of research into the what we think is already an open and shut case. Most of us in America think that that McVee and his friend Nichols were the guys who did it. They were labeled as the disgruntled Army veterans who were motivated by anti-government views, and it's an open and shut case. But is it really? Jaina Davis has the answers to that. And it's interesting to know that we did a little poll online and just asked if folks actually cared about this Oklahoma City bombing, and it's completely in memory. No one even cares about it anymore. It's kind of like faded into the woodwork, replaced by 9-1-1, which is also starting to fade. Now it's the Iraqi war, and pretty soon we'll have the whole Middle Eastern thing with Israel and the Palestinians bringing them to the table. That'll be taking everybody's time. But this is very interesting stuff that you've dug up. First of all, tell me a little bit about your background. You were working at the station and doing a little research. Were you shocked by what you found?
Yes, I was. On April 19th of 1995, I was employed as an investigative reporter for the NBC affiliate in Oklahoma City. And within 24 hours of the bombing, KFOR's news director assigned me to track down local leads regarding possible suspects. Well, I thought her assignment was absolutely absurd, because it was nothing more than monitoring satellite feeds of FBI press conferences. I certainly didn't have the resources or the intelligence contacts in the Washington corridors or in the Israeli Mossad to call up somebody and say, hey, what do you have on Middle Eastern suspects? Because right after the bombing, all roads were pointing toward the Middle East for complicity in the attack on the Murrah building.
Well, they had announced that they were looking for Middle Eastern suspects, and they had a John Doe number two that was a Middle Eastern heritage, and so they had actually mentioned that publicly.
Actually, the very first lead, within 2 to 3 hours of the bombing, the FBI launched an international pursuit of several Middle Eastern-looking males who were seen fleeing the Murrah building in a brown Chevrolet pickup just moments before the blast. But within hours and without explanation, what I discovered was that federal agents instructed Oklahoma County law enforcement officials to cancel that All Points Bulletin and to stop broadcasting it that morning. But they didn't. Channel 4 continued to look in that direction. I also was screening a myriad of phone calls to the newsroom for possible legitimate leads on potential witnesses right here on the ground near the crime scene. And I got to tell you that I had to screen a lot of nutty calls and conspiracy theorists.
Mm-hmm.
But I did get one critical phone call that we decided with news management it was worth following up on. It led me directly to the doorstep mark of what several esteemed intelligence experts later determined to be a Middle Eastern terrorist cell with members of Hamas operating right there in the heart of Oklahoma City, just 30 blocks north.
Now, Hamas is what? Is that a PLO splinter group?
Yes, it is. That's the radical faction of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, mm-hmm. Hamas. It's an arm of the PLO. Now, several American employees to this local property management company that we were investigating claimed to have seen that brown Chevrolet pickup that matched the getaway vehicle that was aggressively pursued by law enforcement parked outside this business office in the days and just very close to the time of the bombing. The company owner, according to my research I discovered, was a Palestinian immigrant from Tel Aviv who had pleaded guilty to several counts of federal insurance fraud in the early 1990s and actually served time in the federal penitentiary. Court records revealed that the FBI suspected the Palestinian businessman, who operated under 8 known aliases, of having connections to the Liberation Organization.
Do you realize, that half of what you're saying is not coming? There's a skip on your phone line?
Actually, somebody's trying to beep in. I apologize for that, and it's causing...
You got to shut that off or something, because it's very difficult for people to keep track of what you're saying when we're losing a lot of words.
I agree. Exactly.
I thought the government was hunting in on you and shutting you off here.
Well, I had a computer crash yesterday. I wonder who's responsible for that.
There you go.
Anyway, we were investigating, as I was saying before, a local property management company about 30 blocks north of the doomed federal building. It was owned and operated by a Palestinian immigrant who, according to federal court records, had pled guilty to several counts of federal insurance fraud in the early 1990s and served time in the penitentiary. This man operated under 8 aliases that we know of. And at the time, according to what I found in the official record in the federal court system in the Western District of Oklahoma, this man was suspected of having ties to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. He was a psychologist from the Oklahoma State Department of Human Services. He funded a vast $4 million worth of rental property through money he had received, and this is according to the federal documents that I have, from siblings living in Baghdad, Iraq, Jerusalem, Dahran, Saudi Arabia, and Amman, Jordan. 6 months prior to the bombing, this Palestinian property owner hires a handful of Iraqi soldiers, ostensibly to do maintenance work on his low-income rental houses. And on April 19th, several witnesses with these Iraqi workers watched in stunned amazement as these Middle Eastern co-workers expressed prideful excitement upon hearing the first radio broadcast that Islamic extremists had claimed responsibility for the attack on the Murrah building. These men were not just saying, great, that's wonderful. They were exuberantly pledging their allegiance to the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, vowing aloud that they would, quote, die for Saddam. My research showed that these same Middle Eastern men that were praising Saddam right after the bombing of the Murrah building were absent from work on one critical day, April 17, 1995. That was the day that Timothy McVeigh rented the Ryder truck in Junction City, Kansas, that carried the bomb that destroyed the Murrah building. Furthermore, two of these men had just completed lengthy trips to the Middle East.
So I assume that you told the FBI this stuff.
Well, it gets a lot deeper than that. We didn't get to that point until what we did was I took a private investigator. We went in a surveillance van and we recorded videotape of these Iraqi soldiers at this property management company. And one of these men, it was just fascinating, we discovered when we were shuttling through the videotape, I froze on a profile shot of an Iraqi soldier who I later learned was known as Hussein Hassam al-Husseini. When al-Husseini's picture was overlaid with the government's official profile sketch of the infamous John Doe number 2, it was arguably a perfect match. So what we did from there was we just fanned out across the city of Oklahoma City. We started visiting businesses, restaurants, strip bars, CD establishments, wherever we thought that McVeigh had a pattern of going. We know that from information we had at Junction City, Kansas, and federal sources and what was coming out publicly is that McVeigh liked to go to strip bars. So my private investigator and another veteran investigative reporter at Channel 4 discovered the first major breakthrough in this investigation where we tied Hussein Hassam al-Husseini, the man who looked arguably just like the profile sketch of John Doe 2, directly to Timothy McVeigh. Two people working at a local bar, strip club, a few miles north of the Murrah building, on April 15th of 1995, viewed a photo spread of 8 different Middle Eastern men. Both of them, independently of each other, picked Hussein Hassam al-Husseini as the man they witnessed drinking beer with Timothy McVeigh in that bar 4 days before the bombing in Oklahoma City. Now, this was not a fleeting encounter, Mark. This was 3 solid hours of being in the presence of this soft-spoken Middle Eastern man and Timothy McVeigh. And Timothy McVeigh was constantly buying beers for his Iraqi friend. So this was a very credible evidence. That's when we contacted the FBI and let them know that what we had. Then, over the next couple years, this is what I found. I interviewed nearly 80 potential witnesses, but I deemed only 24 to be credible because the veracity of their testimonies could be independently corroborated through information that I was gathering, and their stories did not conflict with the government's timeline of the movements of the convicted bombers, Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. All of these 22 witnesses confidently identified 8 specific Middle Eastern men, many of whom are former Iraqi soldiers who served in the first Persian Gulf War. All of these witnesses identified these men assisting, aiding, and abetting McVeigh and Nichols in the weeks, months, days, and hours leading up to the bombing of the Murrah building. As I said before, the most incriminating testimony centered around the man who matched the physical description of the official arrest warrant for the infamous John Doe 2 and also looked almost exactly like, was a dead ringer for the composite sketch, the profile view of the suspect. Witnesses identified this Iraqi soldier in the company of Timothy McVeigh prior to the bombing, drinking beer at the Oklahoma City Tavern on April 15th, filling a large Ryder truck with 100 gallons of diesel fuel the evening before the bombing here in Oklahoma City, timing his run from the Murrah Building one block east shortly before daybreak on the morning of April 19th, climbing into the cab of the Ryder truck that reeked of diesel fuel at a local motel an hour before the explosion. By the way, according to several eyewitnesses, McVeigh was behind the wheel of that Ryder truck as it pulled off the lot and headed downtown. The man identified as his passenger was Hussein Hassam al-Husseini, the former Iraqi soldier. Al-Husseini was also positively identified sitting in that passenger seat of the Ryder truck next to McVeigh a few blocks north of the Murrah Building at around 8:30 a.m. when McVeigh stopped at a local tire store ostensibly to ask for directions. He was identified stepping out of the truck at Ground Zero directly in front of the Murrah Building moments before that massive fertilizer bomb was detonated, and he was identified in the driver's seat of a brown Chevrolet pickup racing away from the downtown area moments after the blast. Now, this evidence that I have gathered also implicates several of Hussein al-Husseini's Arab associates who worked for that property management company, who were hired by the man who was suspected of having ties to the PLO 6 months prior to the bombing. A number of witnesses that have signed sworn declarations observed these Middle Eastern men visiting at an Oklahoma City motel that was just a few miles west of the downtown area, right off Interstate 40. They identified Middle Eastern men in the months, weeks, days, and hours leading up to 9:02 a.m. on April 19th on those motel grounds with Timothy McVeigh, and in a few rare instances, in the presence of Terry Nichols.
Now, you're a credible reporter. You called the FBI. What happened?
Well, that's a story in and of itself. By the time we started discovering this evidence in the spring and summer of 95, I was working very closely with the FBI. They were very, very interested, but eventually they lost interest. It became an exercise in futility to call them up every time we discovered new evidence of a Middle Eastern connection, and we stopped making contact with the FBI after, I would say, June of 1995. By the fall of 1997, I had collated and amassed so much material and 22 witness statements and hundreds of pages of corroborating information, and even made contacts in Washington, D.C. that had corroborated these men were part of an active Hamas terrorist cell. My attorney advised me, you need to surrender this evidence to the FBI. Get documentation that you did so and move on. Mm-hmm. Whether they investigate it or whether they don't, that's not your problem. So it's now the fall of 1997, and I set up an appointment with an FBI agent to surrender all the 22 witness statements and all the corroborating documentation. When I arrived at the Oklahoma City field office of the FBI headquarters, I was accompanied by a notary public, and when I asked the FBI agent, who was receiving the box of documents, to please sign a short statement that said, yes, I have taken Jana Davis's evidence. He said, I don't have a problem with that, Jana. He goes back into the office. He consults with the legal department. He comes back about 20 minutes later, and he's red-faced. He's a little bit embarrassed, and he looks at me, and he says, we can't take the evidence. Go home. I'll call you. So a couple hours later, Mark, he calls me up, and I say to this agent, who I think is a very honorable man, I said, I think I understand the problem here. I'm trying to surrender evidence, and you're about to start Terry Nichols' federal trial in Denver. And for lay people, what that basically means is whatever I give to the prosecution, they have to review it and look for possible exculpatory evidence, evidence that would have mitigated the role of McVeigh and Nichols. Well,
right.
it certainly implicates them up to their eyeballs, but at the same time, it does make them look like mules, a small cog in a large wheel for a Middle Eastern terrorist network.
Yeah. Right.
That should have been turned over to the defense team. That said, the FBI agent tells me, Jana, have your attorney speak to one of the lead prosecutors for the McVeigh and Nichols trials in Denver, and gave me the phone number. My attorney then called the gentleman and the official with the Department of Justice in Denver, and this man had the brazen audacity to tell an attorney, an officer of the court, we do not want Jaina Davis's information. We are not interested in it because we are concerned that we would have to turn those documents over to the defense teams. We do not want any more documents for discovery, is the information and the statement that he gave to my attorney. So my attorney says, well, I'm going to need something to document this conversation. And the official with the Department of Justice, the assistant U.S. attorney, says, well, I'm not going to give you my private business fax line until you promise to redact all references to the Oklahoma City bombing and to witness statements that Jaina Davis is trying to surrender. So this is the incredibly ludicrous, meaningless statement on a fax to the Department of Justice in Denver, to an assistant U.S. attorney who's about to prosecute Terry Nichols. This is what I'm able to have to document that conversation took place, this statement. The United States Department of Justice has not made any investigative demands for any knowledge Jaina Davis may or may not have. I was simply dumbfounded.
Yeah.
Here you have one of the largest criminal investigations in 20th century America. They have dedicated 700 field agents. They have spent hundreds of thousands and even millions of dollars to track down the killers of April 19th. And they won't take a box of documents from a mainstream, credible, reputable reporter who is turning over information that absolutely needs to be checked out. Now, let's fast forward the clock. It's now January 1999. We have just emerged from the bin Laden attacks on the African embassies in August of 1998. You turn on local news, and all you're hearing is this constant mantra coming from ABC, NBC, main network outlets. They're saying bin Laden, according to intelligence sources in the CIA, is expected to strike American targets at any time now. A strike is imminent, and there's a possibility bin Laden will strike on U.S. soil. I receive a phone call from one of my, quote, insider witnesses, and I don't want to give too much detail because it would reveal how this person is connected and knows about what this terrorist cell was doing. But what this individual tells me is, Jaina, these gentlemen, these Iraqi nationals now have bundles of unexplained cash. They're taking trips to Arizona. Remember that state. They're taking unexplained trips to Dallas. Dallas is where the network was based for the African embassy attacks that bin Laden launched in 1998. And they said they're doing the exact same things that they did prior to the Oklahoma City bombing. So this witness begged me, go back to the FBI, give them our sworn affidavits, let the FBI determine what this is all about, if these men are considered a threat to national security. By that time, I had confirmed from the director of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare, Yosef Bodansky, a best-selling author of Bin Laden, the Man Who Declares War on America. This man confirmed for me that the attack on the Murrah building was financed as a middleman via bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda operation. So I knew I had to go back to the FBI. I went back. One very courageous agent, Dan Vogel, took my information, but I didn't go alone, Mark. I went with an attorney, and I went with my husband, and I had a very candid conversation with Agent Vogel. He laid the affidavits out on the desk, and he said, who do we talk to first? Anything that has to do with bin Laden, we are interested in. He treated me with respect. He treated this information with urgency. Later, because I come to find out, through getting to know this agent after he retired, that he knew Channel 4 and this investigation was right on target.
Mm-hmm.
No one called one witness. We never heard from them again. 2 years later, I'm subpoenaed to testify as a witness in one of the preliminary hearings of Terry Nichols' state murder trial, along with three of my attorneys, the Notary Public, and my husband. We all take the stand. We testified to the FBI's absurd reaction and response to me, flatly refusing to take the evidence in 97, then when they took it in 99, never following up, not one phone call. After that, Agent Dan Vogel is subpoenaed. He enters the courtroom on October 29th of 2001, preliminary hearing of Terry Nichols. He prepares to take the stand. The defense lawyers for Terry Nichols put into the court record that Agent Vogel is prepared to testify under oath that he took 22 sworn witness affidavits from Jaina Davis in January of 1999, and that he turned them over to the legal department and his superiors in the Oklahoma City FBI field office, and from there, those documents never made it to either defense team as required by Brady laws and discovery laws. The documents have disappeared. Now we fast forward the clock. It's now May of 2001. You've got this huge debacle that has occurred. The FBI has to admit that they withheld thousands of documents, discovery documents, from the defense teams for the convicted bombers. McVeigh is about to be executed. They have to delay the execution. They launch an Office of Inspector General investigation from the Department of Justice looking into how could these documents have been, quote, inadvertently withheld from the defense teams. The documents are released. They are reviewed. Guess what's missing? 22 affidavits from Jaina Davis of Oklahomans who swear under oath they can specifically tie 8 Middle Eastern men to the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah building. Mm. Those documents to this day are classified as missing.
Hmm. You know, there's a number of things that come in here. One of the things is that immigrant with the alleged ties to the PLO left the day after the bombing and went to Vegas, and his ex-wife, who is American, was killed in that bombing.
You have done your homework.
That's amazing.
Yes, that's very strange. I did a lot of investigation into the Las Vegas crossroads, and what we found was pretty amazing. As you said before, this PLO, I'm sorry, not PLO, Palestinian ex-felon, took regular monthly trips to Las Vegas, where the prime suspects, Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, were known to spend one weekend a month. Why? Because Terry Nichols' son, Joshua, lived in Las Vegas with Nichols' ex-wife, Lana Padilla. What we were trying to find out is, had these three men ever crossed paths? Well, Terry Nichols, we can only tell you this, that the most interesting thing is that Josh Nichols told me, after reviewing a photo lineup of all these Middle Eastern men, that he recognized the face of the Palestinian businessman. He said, that is a very evil man. I said, did you ever see him with your father? He said, I saw him in Las Vegas. I said, where was your father? He said, well, I was at MGM Grand Casino. I said, where was your father? Was he there? And then he declined to talk to me about it. And then his mother took the phone, and he didn't want to talk any further.
Hmm.
That little boy recognized this man. And according to his mother, Lana Padilla, when Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh would come to town to visit her son spent a lot of time with Middle Eastern men during those visits. And they also spent a lot of time at a Las Vegas strip bar and casino known as Glitter Gulch, which was right next door to Binion's Horseshoe, where the Palestinian businessman was known as a, quote, VIP customer and high roller at the poker tables. I did hire a former Air Force EOD specialist who was a bodyguard for some of the dancers at Glitter Gulch, and according to the information he was able to get, she recognized the photograph of this Palestinian businessman and that he would frequently come into Glitter Gulch and be seated with, quote, two skinny white guys. She didn't want to identify McVeigh and Nichols because she said that if she did that, she would end up at the bottom of Lake Mead. That's as far as I was able to carry it. People were too frightened.
Well, the thing is that the United States is active right now in trying to make a PLO Israel peace thing, kind of forcing Israel to accept documents and trying to force the PLO to behave themselves. Does this have any implications long term for this country, this whole conspiracy? And I know that the President Bush has been trying to break up some of these cells. From what you've gathered, are many of them still active in this country?
Absolutely. And there's a lot of splinter groups, and we have the alphabet soup of terrorist groups. Some people say Al-Qaeda, that's what they're concerned with. But really what we need to be concerned with is Islamic Jihad, Hamas, Hezbollah, all of them will work together and set aside their religious differences between the Shiites and the Sunnis in order to attack the great Satan. Now more than ever, Americans are at the greatest risk now that Saddam Hussein has been dethroned and the Iraqi regime has fallen. There's a real battle now for an Islamic state and government to be established in Iraq. And there are people that are loyal to Saddam Hussein that are trained soldiers that immigrated here right after the Gulf War, ex-enemy combatants who once took up arms against our troops during the first Persian Gulf War. 6,000 to 7,000 of these soldiers came over here, resettled here, ostensibly seeking asylum, claiming that if they returned after the Gulf War to their homeland of Iraq, they would be summarily executed because they surrendered to coalition troops. However, last fall, I had several in-depth conversations with a gentleman that was the head of the State Department program to screen these Iraqi POWs, ex-enemy combatants, and those that were seeking refugee status here in the United States. And he told me that there are times where he doesn't sleep nights because there was no documentation. There was no way to thoroughly vet these men and prove that their motives were pure and that they really sought to become American citizens and that they weren't coming over here disguised as refugees when, in fact, they were really Iraqi intelligence operatives dispatched to exact revenge for Saddam Hussein and his humiliating defeat during that first Desert Storm conflict.
You know, if you read America Online and get the views of a cross-section of Americans, and I'm not sure how intelligent they all are, but if you read the postings, the majority of Americans seem to think that, at least a posting on AOL, that if the United States gets rid of Israel and just doesn't bother helping them anymore, that all this will go away.
I personally think that's absurd, but you know, that's political opinions. I'm more interested in a case for justice for those who perished in America's heartland. This is not going away, Mark.
What connections are there between what you found to this and what happened on 9/11?
Well, they're pretty fascinating and pretty disturbing, to say the least. When the second plane slammed into the World Trade Center, I ripped open my files, and I knew when I heard the first reports that they believed that the planes originated, some of them, two of the four actually, from Boston Logan International Airport, that stuck out in my mind. I have to back up a little bit to tell you how I got this information. Back in 1995, when KFOR-TV aired their stories about witnesses who identified this former Iraqi soldier, Hussein al-Husseini, as the infamous John Doe 2 and McVeigh's accomplice, he then turned around and filed a defamation lawsuit against the station.
Mm-hmm.
He did not prevail. The case was thrown out of court in November of 1999, the federal court here, and Judge Timothy Leonard, in a ruling, upheld all 50 statements of fact and opinion that KFOR-TV set forth, which implicated the Iraqi national in the Oklahoma City bombing, and all the information and evidence we set forth on the record that discredited Hussein al-Husseini's alibi. Most remarkable was the fact that Hussein al-Husseini couldn't even produce even one witness affidavit to establish his whereabouts for the critical hours of April 19th. But when he appealed it to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, the oral arguments for that appeal were heard, and this is incredible, the timing was phenomenal, on September 10th, 2001.
Hmm.
Just hours before those planes slammed in to the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. What was interesting was when the 9/11 attacks occurred and I was looking through my files, through the course of the litigation, we had a six-day deposition with Hussein al-Husseini, and he had to turn over all his psychiatric records. And I pulled out from my files, from just a sea of paper and documentation, the most incredible report from his psychiatrist dated November 10th, 1997, when Hussein al-Husseini had come in seeking some type of sedation because he was having anxiety attacks. And his psychiatrist asked him, well, what are you concerned about? Are you concerned that Terry Nichols is on trial in Denver? Are you concerned about the fact that we are now bombing Saddam Hussein for noncompliance with UN inspections for weapons of mass destruction? And he said, no, I'm concerned about my airport job because if something were to happen there, I would be a suspect.
And that's at Logan.
That's Logan International Airport. Then, when we deposed him a year later, come to find out, we asked him the same question. Why did you tell your psychiatrist there? Were you concerned that they were going to find out that you were somehow, quote, fingered by a television station in Oklahoma City as being, quote, you know, John Doe 2 in the attack on the Murrah building? He said, no. I was concerned that if something were to happen there, that I would be blamed for it. And then he went on to talk about the fact that he was living with two former Iraqi soldiers from the first Persian Gulf War who were who had their own business providing food catering services to the commercial airlines at Boston Logan Airport. We all know how law enforcement speculated those box cutters got on board.
Right.
And that was through the food services.
Mm.
So, you know, the connections were pretty uncanny. There was also some connections to a local motel where we had determined it was actually the staging ground for McVeigh to meet and conspire with the Middle Eastern suspects, and where he was seen pulling off the lot in the Ryder truck that reeked of diesel fuel with witnesses who identified Hussein al-Husseini as his passenger. Go back to that motel now. It's now September of 2001, and the owner calls me within 48 hours of the first pictures being shown of all the hijackers. And he says, I recognize three of those men. And I'm thinking, no, there's just no way. And he says, Jaina, absolutely. And the desk clerk was also a witness corroborating this, that in August of 2001, about a month before the attacks, according to the motel owner, Zacharias Moussaoui, who is now considered, quote, the 20th hijacker who's awaiting his trial, Marwan al-Shehi and Muhammad Atta, who was their spiritual leader of sorts for the 9/11 hijackers, came in to that motel and asked to stay there at a room. And the motel owner was there doing some work inside the office, and Atta actually crossed the room and walked up to him and looked him in the eye and spoke to him for at least 2 to 3 minutes. And they wanted a discounted rate, and in order to do that, they would need a kitchenette, but there were no more kitchenettes available.
Mm-hmm.
So the owner apologized, said, I don't have anything for it. He goes, we really want to stay here. We have heard such wonderful things about your hotel. And he says, well, how long are you going to be in town? He goes, well, we're attending flight school in Norman. And the owner thought that was odd because there are plenty of, you know, budget motels between Oklahoma City and Norman, south of there, which is 28 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't even really make sense why they wanted to stay there, but he said, look, there's plenty of places from here to there, and, you know, if a kitchenette becomes available, maybe you can come in the next few weeks, and that was the end of the conversation. And, of course, they parted. But the reason why this man stood out in his mind so much is because it was just a blistering hot summer day here in Oklahoma, and he was wearing a flight jacket.
Mm.
So he remarks to the to the motel desk clerk, when the guys walk out, he says, you know, he must really come from a place that's cold because why would he be wearing a winter coat in the middle of August? So it stood out in his mind. Plus, I've got to admit, I'm not a very good eyewitness, but Muhammad Atta's face would stand out in my mind. And it did in the mind of the motel clerk. And here's what's interesting. When the motel owner gave me this testimony, I had nothing to prove that Zacharias Moussaoui, Muhammad Atta, and Marwan al-Shehi were in Oklahoma, or on U.S. soil even, in August of 2001 when this supposedly took place. Come to find out, 3 months later, when the official indictment comes down for Zacharias Moussaoui, he had not only attended flight school in Norman from February through May of 2001, he stayed in Oklahoma through August of 2001 because he was going to receive and did receive a $14,000 money transfer from train stations in Dusseldorf and Hamburg, Germany, right here in Oklahoma City.
Hmm.
Proximity was there. And the two hijackers that were known to travel together were Marwan al-Shehi and Muhammad Atta. That information had not been made public when this motel owner came forward and chose out of all the hijackers which ones he saw with Zacharias Moussaoui on his motel property a month before the 9/11 attacks. Come to find out, there is information that was published in the Associated Press and MSNBC that Marwan al-Shehi and Muhammad Atta traveled to Oklahoma City and visited several flight schools in July of 2000, the summer before. So the pattern of travel and the two being together was previously established.
And flashing back to Oklahoma City, what is the Philippine factor?
The Philippine factor is just pretty phenomenal. I obtained several filings, confidential sealed filings by McVeigh's defense team that outlined reasons why his attorneys and investigators believe that Terry Nichols received bomb-making expertise from Iraqi intelligence based in the Philippines. Now, we all remember Nichols was just a small-time Kansas farmer and a, you know, gun trader of modest means, obviously. But he took expensive, unexplained trips to the Philippines frequently without his Filipino mail-order bride. And phone records that I have in my possession show that Nichols received and made numerous calls to a boarding house in Cebu City, which, according to McVeigh's defense lawyers, sheltered students from a local university there in Cebu, well known for Islamic militancy. And in an attempt to cover their tracks, both Nichols and McVeigh used a phone debit card to make a series of cryptic phone calls to untraceable numbers in the Philippines from public payphones in Junction City, Kansas. So they were definitely trying to cover any phone records that could be later retrieved from anybody if they were in fact arrested. The court records revealed that the Oklahoma City bomber, Terry Nichols, was in Cebu City, this is very critical, in December of 1994. That was his last trip back to the Philippines right before the bombing. He was in there the same month and the same day as the convicted mastermind of the first World Trade Center attack, Ramzi Youssef. Now, we asked the question, did Ramzi Youssef, a Middle Eastern terrorist, ever cross paths with Terry Nichols in the Philippines? Well, according to the sworn statement of the late Edwin Angeles, who was the co-founder of the Filipino Muslim terrorist group known as Abu Sayyaf, that meeting did indeed take place in the early 1990s on the island of Mindanao. Edwin Angeles, the member of this Abu Sayyaf group, said he was present when Terry Nichols, Ramzi Youssef, and two Middle Eastern co-conspirators met to discuss the acquisition of firearms, and they discussed in detail bomb-making techniques. Beyond that, on April 19th of 1995, a Middle Eastern terrorist known as Abdul Hakim Murad, who was later convicted with Ramzi Youssef in the foiled plot to blow up the 12 U.S. airliners in Manila, it was known as Project Bojinka, which in Arabic means the big boom. Abdul Hakim Murad, on the day of the bombing, corroborates the testimony of the leader of the Abu Sayyaf group, Edwin Angeles. He told a prison guard at a New York detention center where he was being confined that as a member of the Philippine Liberation Army, he himself was responsible for the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building. In addition to verbally confessing, Murad takes it a step further, and he puts this admission in writing. He wants to give us, he's boasting, he's mocking, because consider this, Mark, they had Abdul Hakim Murad in custody for months. They had been interrogating him since January. They transferred him in February, early March, to a New York detention center from the Philippines. And here he was, giving up extraordinary detail about a plot that was foiled by U.S. authorities, thankfully, with Ramzi Youssef to blow up these U.S. airliners over the Pacific Ocean that were originating out of Manila. And he was giving them details of Ramzi Youssef's involvement in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. He was giving details about a future plan to take commercial general aviation aircraft, load them with explosives, and fly them into CIA headquarters at Langley. But what he wasn't telling them was that there was a plot afoot to bomb an American federal building and that a Kansas farmer had been traveling down to the Philippines and meeting with his Iraqi intelligence associates, including Ramzi Youssef. So he was gleeful on April 19, 1995, in essence saying, nose-thumbing the American government. Yes, you interrogated. Yes, I gave you information. But no, I never told you that within a few short weeks, people would die in America's heartland. So it's pretty phenomenal. Do U.S. authorities want to talk about those records? No. I was one of the first reporters to get possession of those records.
Was Saddam Hussein involved in this in any way, you think?
Well, it's very important to go back and reconstruct. It's so hard to prove state-sponsored terrorism, to get that dead bang connection to say Saddam Hussein gave the official order, go bomb the American Federal Building. But here's what I can tell you, okay? And that is that the director of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare, Yosef Bodansky, he issued a prior warning that stated on February 27th of 1995, there will be, now notice the word, Iran-sponsored Islamic attack on U.S. soil. The two primary targets were based in Washington, D.C. They were Congress in the White House. Well, that's a chilling foreshadowing of the events of 9/11. When that warning from Yosef Bodansky was disseminated to all the essential law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies in Washington, they beefed up security in the capital city. Then the focus from the Islamic terrorists shifts from Washington, D.C. to America's heartland. And on March 3rd of 1995, the director of the Congressional Task Force issues an updated warning that states the terrorists now plan to strike at, quote, the heart of the U.S. 12 cities are placed on the potential target list because of the radical Islamic groups and factions and networks operating within those cities. And yes, Oklahoma City was on that original list. But more importantly, the task force had learned that the Middle Eastern terrorists that were planning this terror campaign had recruited two Lily Whites to carry out the bombing of an American federal building. Now, just so your audience understands, Lily Whites has nothing to do with ethnicity. In the lexicon of the intelligence community, it refers to individuals who have no criminal history and no obvious ties to Middle Eastern terrorist organizations. Timothy McVeigh, a decorated Gulf War veteran, and Nichols, a farmer and a former soldier, definitely fit that criterion. And also keep in mind, these 1995 task force warnings were generated from multiple intelligence sources from several Middle Eastern countries over an extended period of 18 months prior to the Oklahoma City bombing. And information that was flowing into the hands of Yosef Bodansky of the task force was gleaned from terrorist conferences which took place in the fall of 94 and early 95, in which Iran's overriding desire to strike within, quote, the heart of the great Satan, that's the United States, was unveiled. And Osama bin Laden was in attendance at some of those conferences. Mm. Now, there is ample evidence from the Congressional Task Force that an international terrorism offensive was sponsored by Iran and Syria was about to be launched inside the United States sometime at the start of the Iranian New Year on March 21st of 1995. But I'd like to stress this right now, that at no time did I uncover any evidence that would indicate that law enforcement that received this warning had enough information to stop the bomb. They had no idea that the plan involved specifically a Ryder truck or specifically the Murrah building. They just knew Oklahoma City was a potential list. They knew a federal building was at the top of the list of objectives.
Right.
But herein lies your problem. If you go out and you round up these Middle Eastern men, then that warning has credibility. That warning has been authenticated. And then comes the liability. Did you do enough to stop the bomb? Mm. You know, the American people are very forgiving. They want and need the truth. But I do believe, in part, the reason why this did not come out during the former administration was because of the enormous liability that was perceived of just not stopping that bomb. But keep in mind, while Yosef Bodansky had information that Iran and Syria were about to launch a terrorism campaign on U.S. soil, he also discovered that Iraqi assets were, in fact, used for that operation. And that's what we found on the ground here in Oklahoma City.
I guess the question that comes to mind, because we have to wrap this thing up, is why has the mainstream press ignored this whole story? I mean, I never see it anywhere.
Well, you know, I can only speculate on that. In part, they did buy in to what they were being fed as the official line during the trials. Also think it's part of institutional guilt, but I think it's part of institutional arrogance. How can a reporter from a Midwestern station in Oklahoma City and a broadcast news reporter at that, we're not considered, quote, true journalists among the print journalists. I always, you know, laugh mm-hmm. at that. But I understand that in part because I think that a lot of television journalism is superficial, meaningless, lazy reporting, to be honest with you. But the bottom line here is, what I'm confronting among journalists and the Wall Street Journal is definitely the exception to the rule, and that is if we didn't find it, it didn't exist because we're the national media.
Right.
We find everything. How can a reporter in Oklahoma City? And here's where I say in return, there's nothing great about Jana Davis. I just happen to be living within a few miles of the crime scene. And by virtue of the fact that I basically have a news bureau stationed right here on the soil, not far from where that truck bomb murdered 171 Oklahomans and injured hundreds more, by virtue of the fact that I'm here, I had the time, the resources, and the tenacity to stick with it. And they didn't have the resources to dedicate to that. They couldn't bring in satellite offices and do nothing but look into the Oklahoma City bombing. It's not feasible within the news budget. So, you know, if you're living on the ground here, by virtue of the fact that I was here, and plus, I'm very discerning, and I do sift through a lot of stuff, and I don't ascribe to any of the theories that say that the government could have stopped the bomb, or that John Doe 2 was somehow an undercover government informant, or there were multiple charges in the building that the government had to know were planted there. None of that. So you can't marginalize Jana Davis as a right-wing extremist reporter. The Wall Street Journal, the former director of the CIA, James Woolsey, the former deputy director of counterterrorism for the Department of State, Larry Johnson, the former chief of human intelligence for the Defense Intelligence Agency, Colonel Patrick Lang, the former chief impeachment counsel for the prosecution of the trial that impeached President Clinton in the House of Representatives in 1998, David Shippers. These men have reputable standing in not only the news media, but in the community at large, in Washington, D.C. and beyond. And they stand by the credibility of this information. Hmm. It needs to be checked out.
Well, folks can check it out at janadavis.com, janadavis.com. And we'll have you on again sometime to follow the story up.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks so much for coming on.
I appreciate it.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.